Welcome to the Health and Human Services Committee. Today is Tuesday, February 8th. I apologize for getting started later. We had a number of our committee members up in the Finance Committee where we just had to take a vote. So I assume that those members will be making their way down here and we'll announce a quorum when we have it. But this morning we wanted to have some conversation, some information presented to the committee about public mental health programs. And we've got a number of testifiers who have agreed to come and present some information to the committee. We appreciate your help on this and your willingness to do that. I'd like to invite, I'm going to take testifiers in the order that we have on the agenda. Mr. Bill Weiss, Acting Director of the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Division, and welcome to the committee. And please introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair and members, let me adjust this real quick, and members of the committee, my name is Bill Weiss, and I'm the Acting Director of the Department's Alcohol and Drug Abuse Division, which is the designated single state authority on alcohol and drug abuse. Addiction is a preventable and treatable disease, and the interests of society are best served to individuals and communities with a comprehensive range of chemical health services. The division is responsible to develop and maintain an effective chemical health services for Minnesota that is data-driven, encourages and supports evidence-based practices, expands use of successful models, and systematically monitors outcomes. The overall goal is to reduce alcohol and drug use, as well as the resulting social and economic costs, the awarding and monitoring of grant funds for prevention and treatment services, and providing technical assistance to counties, providers, and tribes, and managed care organizations, and with working many internal and external stakeholders to gather input in developing effective public policy. Five documents have been prepared for today's presentation to illustrate the fiscal operations and activity of divisions. This includes a pie chart of a division's operating budget for state fiscal year 10 and 11, a grid of the division's activities, listing of grants for state fiscal year 11, a funding composition of the Consolidated Chemical Dependency Treatment Fund, and a brief background and key information as well. So let's start. I believe it's page 3 in your packet. As you see, this is the pie chart here. This is what I'd like to go through real quickly. As you can see, the largest expenditure, which is 87%, is the Consolidated Chemical Dependency Treatment Fund. The fund pays for chemical treatment services for eligible persons for medical assistance, family investment program, general assistance medical care, or meets the 100% federal poverty guidelines and is assessed for needing addiction treatment services. This also includes individuals covered by third-party payment sources if their health plan pays less than 100% of treatment that meets the criteria for addiction treatment services. The Consolidated Chemical Dependency Treatment Fund incorporates federal, state, county, as well as third-party and recipient collections. The funds are administered by counties, tribes, managed care organizations for eligible individuals needing addictive treatment services. So that's the 87%. Next on this pie chart, our federal block grant received is 9% as well. And then we have our federal strategic prevention framework state and grant, that's 1%, and state grants 1% as well, which are primarily American Indian grants. Staff costs are 2% and non-salary costs are less than 0.5%. I'd like to go to the next page, which is the this activity grid. And I just went through that top row, the Consolidated Chemical Dependency Treatment Fund. And what I want to illustrate today, the staffing patterns and dollars and folks we've served. So on that first row, we have 9 staff allocated to this function. We've served 340 providers. There's annual cost of $138,374,000, and we had 28,176 placements for state fiscal year 10. And that last column, it shows you where the funds are from, state appropriations, federal, and there is an MOE for this maintenance of effort. The maintenance effort is the average amount spent on treatment service expenditures for the past 2 years.
Mr. Weiss, can I stop you right there for just a second? I wanted to ask you a question.
Certainly.
The chart that we're looking at on page 4 of your handout that you were just referring to, and you talked about the number of individuals or recipients served in 2010, 28,176 in the CCDTF segment of your budget. Do you have data or do you collect data on the results of those placements? What happened? Were people, to say they're served, to me suggests they were put into or they went into some program. But what has been the result of being in the program? Were the people involved, did they have a positive effect, negative, no effect? Do you keep data on that?
I do have some information to jump around on this fact sheet here, and it shows you in the back the reasons for discharge, which is our. So you can see that on this sheet, it's number 5 on the back, that the completion for being in treatment was 60%. And we do know that completion of treatment is an indicator for success. I listed the top 4 here. I didn't list them all, but the other remaining are very small. You can see at 20% patients left without approval, a 9% due to behavior of the patient, and then 6% transferred to other programs. So this is the information that we get through our DANE system that provides this level of discharge.
And thank you, Mr. Weiss. That's helpful. Another question with respect to that number, do you also keep record of individuals that have been in programs more than once? In other words, of the 28,176, are these all first-time enrollees in programs?
Or we do have that information, and I did not bring it today. It's in our packet. I certainly can provide that to you. It shows the number of episodes and then, you know, up to 3 to 4 more. And that's a number that we can provide you.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Okay. So I wanted to go into the treatment support and recovery maintenance. I guess it's a row. Data indicates that various diverse populations do not succeed in treatment at the same rate as the general population, and that prevalence of substance abuse is higher in these populations. Our efforts that we dedicate in supporting models of treatment that focus on strengths as well as the needs of this population. So if you look at the treatment support and recovery maintenance services, we have 10 FTEs dedicated to that function, 27 grants at $6,714, and we've served 2,539 individuals. And then the subtypes, this last just provides you a listing of those particular types of grant. And there's no maintenance effort for this particular role. I like to go into the prevention services. In order to reduce the prevalence of alcohol and other drugs use among state's population and the age of first use, the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Division promotes evidence-based prevention strategies and model programs. Minnesota's goal is to provide effective and efficient prevention programming statewide through various grant funds. So you can see on the prevention line, we have 6 FTEs, 29 grants at $9,131,000, served 55,484. These are all federal dollars in this column, and there is a maintenance of effort that we need to spend 20% of our block grant on prevention services.
And Mr. Weiss, on that prevention service section you were just speaking about, the 55,484 recipients or individuals, what exactly did they get? I'm not clear when you talk about prevention services. What was? Does that mean that they participated in some presentation, or what exactly is the is the individual receiving as a result of this program?
As you can see on the right, there is a granting fund category, and through there's various efforts that individuals receive some kind of contact through these particular grants. Now, the one that on the bottom there is probably the one that's the most prominent in what we're trying to do statewide here. It is a statewide SAMHSA grant to introduce a statewide prevention program. I could provide a breakdown of each one of these if you'd like to have that that information.
Well, and Mr. Weiss, what I'm trying to understand, I guess, with all these services is just what we're doing and what we're accomplishing. Mm-hmm. And I understand prevention services as an umbrella. We're trying to do things to prevent something from happening. I'm interested in knowing how effective those things are. Are we preventing people? Do we have goals?
Yes.
Are they measurable?
Yes.
How do we measure those things? And when we say that we have served a number of people, it's unclear to me exactly what we're saying. Are we saying that that we prevented 55,000 people from something, or what exactly are we doing here?
Well, what I can provide you is a listing of, we do have measures that indicate decrease in the use of alcohol amongst teens and young adults. So each one of the prevention has specific goals and measures that we have. I didn't bring that level of detail here today. If you would like that, I certainly have it available and can provide that to you. That breaks down the prevention in terms of what are those measures, where have we accomplished success, and give that to you if you like.
Thank you. I'd appreciate that.
Okay. Excellent.
Mr. Weiss, Senator Rosen.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to that point, Mr. Weiss, there is prevention is what this is all about, and it just seems like it's very hard to figure out what a prevention coordinator does, what the prevention centers do, all that. But my question really is to number E and the framework state incentive.
Yes.
And you said SAMHSA goals.
Well,
how much is the grant, and is it ongoing, or is it just appropriated just for this biennium?
It's a five-year
Mr.
grant.
Mr. Weiss.
Excuse me. Mr. Chair, Senator, it's a five-year grant, I believe, of $10.5 million. Comes from SAMHSA. I believe we just released an RFP for recipients who could apply. This is a grant that has been distributed nationwide. So that's what we're in the process of trying to get the RFP out so we can get recipients to respond and get the money out. 85% of the money goes to communities.
Senator Rosen.
And in the form, how does it go to the community, Mr. Weiss? Does it go?
Mr. Weiss?
Chair, Senator, the RFP will go out, and then it's a competitive grant for folks to apply for.
Senator Rosen?
And Mr. Weiss, just a little more information. What's the guidelines?
Sure. Let me go to
Mr. Weiss, go ahead.
$10 million is significant.
Yes.
And so
yes.
I'd like to know just the guidelines and the rules and the accountability in the end, if there is some kind of performance-based measure at the end of this.
Certainly.
Mr. Weiss.
Senator Hahn and Senator Rosen, the requirements of the grant that come from SAMHSA require a great deal of evaluation, requirements for each recipient that receives the particular grant. I don't have all the information of what's required, but it's heavily dedicated to evaluation, and there's a part of the grant that you have to dedicate a certain amount for evaluation, but I don't have those particular areas. I know that three of the areas we're looking at is 30-day use of alcohol for youth, binge drinking for youth, and then also drinking for adults 18 to 25. Those are very specific goals that the grant is requiring us to concentrate on. So when the RFP goes out, people submit their proposals. They'll have to demonstrate that they can meet those particular outcomes.
Thank you.
Okay, women's services. All right. So on the bottom there, we have women's services. the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Division funds projects to improve access, treatment, supplemental services, and community support for pregnant women and women with dependent children who need addiction treatment services. This is important as counties and tribes recognize the role substance use plays in child welfare cases. So on the bottom, you can see we have two FTEs dedicated to the women's services, 10 grants at $4,987,000, and it served 1,500 folks. And you can see this is federal dollars with a maintenance of effort. And this maintenance of effort is funds that equal or exceed expenditures from federal fiscal year 1994, which is about 5% of our federal block grant. And then the last column, almost the last, is the American Indian Services. Three FTEs, 22 grants. The budget is $2,835,000, serves 7,117 individuals, and a state and federal amounts. And then the last is our administrative operations. This includes fiscal and administrative support for the division, four FTEs at 637. And so that is it for this sheet. And I wanted to comment real quickly on three key messages I want to communicate today in terms of what the division is doing. We have the rate reform project, and the department is responsible to develop a uniform rate methodology with graduated reimbursement scales for acuity and complexity that is cost neutral for it's cost neutral and it's effective this July. This is the result of a directive from the Center for Medicaid Services and the 209 legislature due to vast discrepancies in provider rates for alike services. Counties, tribes, and managed care organizations contract with service providers who produce these varied rates. And so we're ordered to go ahead and look at how we can even the rates across the state. The second one I want to bring up real quickly is our primary care initiative. The division is promoting access to alcohol abuse and dependency services through partnering with primary care clinics to produce screening, brief intervention, and treatment services. The project involves working with primary clinics and their leadership to embrace the screening protocol developed by the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism. The goal is to provide physicians with additional tools in educating their patients and providing care. Working with primary care physicians to address alcohol use and dependency can increase services as well as reduce stigma. And then the last part is the Strategic Prevention Framework State Incentive Grant, or they call it the SPFSIG for abbreviation. This program provides an effective, comprehensive process, a direction, and a common set of goals to adopt and integrate all levels. Research has shown that to effectively change attitudes, perception, and ultimately behavior, prevention strategies must include a comprehensive approach that addresses both the individual and the environment. Substance abuse strategies that address the shared environment are the most effective for large populations and are the most cost-effective. Again, the priorities of this is to reduce past 30-day alcohol among youth, reduce binge drinking among youth, and then reduce drinking among aged 18 to 25-year-old. So Senator Rolls, and those are the particular goals that are acquired under that particular grant.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Berglund.
If I might just add that the brief intervention strategies are evidence-based and proven to reduce spending. And I believe in Minnesota they're being used in hospitals with emergency rooms. And there, when a brief intervention takes place by medical personnel, it's very low-cost added service. But it has a great impact in terms of reducing health care costs in the future. And it's been proven that there is quite a bit of receptiveness when there is a crisis that brings someone into an emergency room due to alcohol or drug abuse, and there is an intervention made by a healthcare professional, that the follow-up is fairly good among the recipients.
Thank you. Mr. Weiss.
Yes. The last I want to go through is you have a handout that says Consolidated Chemical Emergency Treatment Fund on the top. And real briefly, just wanted to point out this state obligation. This is a very complex formula, but if you look on the very right-hand column, the state obligation here of $102,659,000 is the state obligation for this fund.
So, Mr. Weiss, can you help us? Are you talking
sure,
about page six?
Slide six, I believe, in your package.
Thank you.
Again, real quickly, just wanted to show the state obligation for this fund, right-hand column. I was looking at fiscal year 2011, the $102 million. I just wanted to point out that this is the state obligation after the revenues and collections. So I just wanted to have that available to you. If you have questions about that, certainly can bring back information if you like. I'm not the true expert on this fund. We have staff that can provide more detail if you'd like that. And then the last, this fact sheet I provided today, this is just a fact sheet that gives more information about the division. And Senator Hahn, in there is those discharge summary statistics in the back. So that's what I have for today. Any questions?
Thank you. Any members, any further questions for Mr. Weiss? Thank you for your appearing today. And if you could provide the committee with some of the information you indicated at some date in the near future, we'd appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
Next, we'd like to invite Mr. John Anderson, co-director of the Adult Mental Health Division, to join us. And members, just for the record, we do have a quorum.
Chairman Hahn, could we change the agenda just a little bit and have children's mental health go first?
Absolutely. We'd be happy to do that. Is that Glennis Edwall? Welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourselves for the record.
Thank you, Senator Hahn. My name is Glennis Edwall, and I'm the director of the Children's Mental Health Division at the Department of Human Services. And I am delighted to be joined today by Dr. Megan Gunner from the University of Minnesota. We'll introduce her a little more fully in just a second. I will talk very quickly about an overview of our division and only very, very briefly about its funding. But I was asked to specifically address two of the grant programs funded by the legislature.
Edwell, I'm sorry to interrupt you. Could I ask you to move the microphone close just so that we can pick up your voice more clearly? Thank you.
Even closer.
Even closer?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Microphones and I always have this problem. After just a very brief introduction, I had been asked specifically to address two of the grant programs that the Children's Mental Health Division administers that are funded by the legislature, our Early Intervention Grant and our Child Welfare and Juvenile Justice Screening Grant. And so I will do that. And Dr. Gunner is here to provide the scientific background for what we're trying to do in early childhood, and really appreciate her brief time available to us this morning. The Children's Mental Health Division at DHS has several key functions, very specifically, we oversee county human services agencies and their role as the local mental health authority, a function that includes monitoring county activity and children's mental health spending, and working to ameliorate service gaps and create innovative approaches to meeting needs. Secondly, we administer grant programs, and we'll talk about a couple of those very specifically today. Third, we provide clinical expertise and policy development assistance to the healthcare administration in the design, implementation, and administration of children's mental health benefits in Minnesota healthcare programs. And five, we work with many others to expand venues and create new mechanisms for promoting mental health development, lowering risks for development of disorders, enhancing early intervention and better access to service, and building higher service quality. I want to summarize those goals really quickly. They've come out of our long work with stakeholders, beginning with the 2002 Children's Mental Health Task Force that I'll talk about later this morning that really gave us the goals of helping to provide a children's mental health system that is early in its interventions, easy for families to access, and effective in the services it provides. And those three services, those three goals really also summarize the fiscal sheet that you see in front of you about the way we function operationally. So if you can keep those words in mind, early, easy, and effective, that's what we're trying to do. Now, before I turn to our specific grants that I was asked to address, then let me introduce Dr. Gunner, Regents Professor and highly distinguished colleague over many years whose presence I much appreciate here today.
Welcome, Doctor.
Thank you very much. Let me just very briefly elaborate on the credentials, briefly, so you can get a background for why Dr. Edwell asked me to be here today. I am a professor and researcher at the University of Minnesota. I also am the associate director there of their center, our center, on neurobehavioral development. I also direct a federally funded multi-university research center on early experience, stress, and neurobehavioral development. And in my own research deals with the long-term impact on brain development of early experiences of neglect, deprivation, and abuse. And finally, I'm also a member of a national think tank of researchers from around the country that evaluates what we do and don't know based on the science of early development about brain and behavioral development, and we task ourselves then with working very hard to distill that information, hopefully in English and not scientees, for use by policymakers like you. So it's in all those worlds I come to you today, and I will be very brief. What I'm trying to do here is give you a sense of the bullet points based on decades of early developmental science about what we know about early brain development in the context of the kind of programs that Dr. Edwell will be talking to you about today. We know, based on this science, solid science, that the experiences of young children affect the developing architecture of their brains. We know that the roots of many physical and mental disorders, not all, but many, lie in disordered, neglectful, stressful, and frightening early life experiences. We know that such experiences affect brain architecture and brain chemistry in young children. And we know that the young brain, thankfully, is plastic and changeable. It's still developing. We know that early and effective interventions can allow developing brain architecture and chemistry to repair itself. We also know that for most children, supportive, stable relationships are the core ingredient of healthy brain development, and that disordered, neglectful, frightening relationships are the core ingredient in disordered brain development. I want to step aside here and say that not all problems are based in relationships. Autism is not. Fetal alcohol syndrome is not based in relationship problems. There are those problems. We're good at identifying them, and we have effective treatments for those. But children with those problems also create tremendous challenges for their parents, and their parents need help in order not to have relationship issues develop for them. For young children, effective interventions repair those relationships, and that once the child's significant relationships are repaired, the developing brain is capable early on of shifting back onto a healthy neurodevelopmental trajectory. We also know that child behavior is our best assay of significant problems in core relationships, and we're not talking here about isolated behaviors like your child is biting somebody else at childcare. That we're talking about constellations of behaviors and behavior patterns that together raise red flags, and we're good at being able to identify those constellations. In addition, we know that we're more likely to find children whose behavior raises red flags if we look among those being raised by families who are under tremendous economic and emotional stress. All those families, of course, could use help in accessing resources to support them in caring for their children, but that is hugely costly, and most are not going to need intense interventions at all. But for those who do and who are asking for it, the grants that you'll be hearing about from Dr. Edwell today allow families to access assessment and treatment early when repair is the most possible, and are probably some of the most cost-effective programs that we can support.
Thank you, Beth. Any questions for Dr. Gunner at this point? All right. Continuing, Ms. Edwell, did you have further comments to make?
Yes, I will continue then with the PowerPoint that was distributed. It says Health and Human Services, Finance Committee, Children's Mental Health Division. Two slides per page, if that helps you identify it. I'm going to cut through a lot of the background that actually just provides more detail to what Dr. Gunner was just describing. But let me start with the very first slide there that says parents request early identification. The 2002 task force that I just alluded to, which gave us our strategic direction, included numerous parent focus groups where parents were the ones who reported long delays between parent awareness of child problems and the system response to that awareness. So schools and even our healthcare system often took parents' concerns less seriously than they might and made kids essentially fail and parents bear the distress of that for some time. And they asked us to try to do something about that, which is a lot of the background of why we have focused so much on early identification. I'm going to skip through the background slides, though would be happy to talk more about any of those you'd be interested in. But to go to page 7, to actually specifically begin to address the grants in question here, how are the early childhood mental health grants supporting healthy development of young, high-risk children? Well, this grant program was passed by the 2007 legislature, and so after an RFP process, we had the first fully functioning grants in 2009. Since 2009, 1,473 children under the age of 5 in 28 counties have received early childhood mental health services, clinical or ancillary, through the grants. This grant program is just about $1 million, so it is not very large, but we've tried to make the money go as far as possible. 89% of those families were reported receiving their first mental health services through this grant program. 35% of the children served come from communities of color, the largest group being African American, and the services are provided in locations easy for families to access, that second goal about ease, so that most of them are either in early childhood settings or directly in the families' homes. What are the actual services being provided? Well, they are both clinical and ancillary. And I think some of these numbers will help perhaps to give a better sense of what is actually done under the grants. 409 children received 18,000 sessions of clinical service, which is a lot. Much of it reimbursed through Medicaid or private insurance, with this grant only paying the margins of what is unreimbursable. 228 of those children received diagnostic assessments. 216 received psychotherapy, predominantly family therapy. We can talk about that at length. You don't intervene in a relationship problem without actually intervening with the relationship. And so the interventions are very much based around the family. 311 children received skills training, either individually or as a family, and only 2 received medication management. I think that's very significant. A lot of the philosophy of this program has been to reinforce those relationship-based therapies in lieu of trying to get medication as a solution for either isolated or patterned behaviors. So we're very happy, actually, with that result. Ancillary services are the kinds of services that would not get health insurance reimbursement either in Minnesota healthcare programs or in private insurance, but are often really necessary for families to be able to structure themselves to deal with the multiple stresses of having a child with a significant difficulty. And so 1,363 children, which overlaps with the 409 getting clinical services, received services that are generally non-reimbursable, the largest of which was participation in an incredible year's curriculum, which is an evidence-based prevention program. These were often children who might not have reached the threshold in this grant program for a diagnosable condition, but nonetheless, participation in this program could have a preventative effect. And then you'll see the other things for care coordination and a lot of both parent consultations and teacher consultations to try to keep everybody on the same page. Continued progress. Both inside this grant program as well as beside it in other activities that we are doing in early childhood, the Children's Mental Health Division is trying to ensure that all 11 economic regions in the state have at least 2 mental health agencies that have specialized to serve children birth to 5 and their families. To address some of the disparities, which are actually in the background slides that I skipped over, but which are significant for our African-American and American Indian populations, the division is also focusing these efforts on at least 3 tribal mental health agencies at any time. What do the grants actually do? They provide support by providing monies for treatment for uninsured or underinsured children and their families, and then an enormous amount of training. And it's a training that I also want to focus on because we don't believe that every mental health professional, even those who call themselves children's mental health professionals, are really equipped to deal with young children and their families. And so we have done an enormous amount of training. So we are training on it's called the DC 0 to 3R there, which stands for the Diagnostic Classification 0 to 3 system, which is specifically tailored to produce developmentally appropriate and developmentally limited diagnoses. Things like regulatory disorders that emerge in early childhood and can be addressed very successfully then don't necessarily carry through to an adult or even adolescent diagnosis, but we want to solve them while they're there and before they become more serious. I think of this as the otitis media work of the children's mental health system. That is, you want to treat it, you do not want it to fester, you do not want it to create other complications, and it can be treated successfully early. Secondly, parent-child interaction therapy, which is one of the best evidence-based practices specifically for the birth to six population. And these interventions are strongly supported by research evidence, and we are also trying to make sure we have at least two agencies in every region of the state that are certified to do this. We are training on outcome instruments and collecting outcome evidence through our grants as well as through our Minnesota healthcare programs. And the training for this population is on the Early Childhood Service Intensity Instrument, the ECSI, which is parallel to the CASI and the LOCUS that you may be familiar with for older children and adults, and the Strengths and Difficulties Questionnaire, which does indeed measure both the decline in difficulties manifested by the child as well as an increase in prosocial strengths. All of these training efforts have led to strong collaborations with Minnesota health plans and with primary care. Minnesota health plans, for example, are very interested in the lists of providers we have trained so that they know who to panel in various areas of the state, and we're very grateful for that kind of collaboration. And then there are a number of references there. If I can, for the interest of time, let me go on to the screening grants that I was also asked to address. I want to be very careful that it's clear that the early childhood grants do not include an explicit screening component. They are for services for children whose families in one way or another have already identified a problem and are seeking help for that problem. The Child Welfare and Juvenile Justice Screening Grants, on the other hand, are explicitly screening grants, although they are not only screening grants. And I'll explain that more in just a second. So I'm on page 11 of the PowerPoint handout. The impetus for this grant program also came from the 2002 task force that I described. There was stakeholder consensus in that task force on being sure that children who were at the highest risk were the ones we were sure we identified and screened. There was long discussion about universal screening, and there was not consensus on that. But there was that we have some populations where the incidence of mental illnesses is so high that we must attend to them. And those were specifically the child welfare and juvenile justice populations. Just the most typical national statistics for these two populations show roughly two-thirds of the children that are involved in those systems have serious mental health problems that we do need to address. Juvenile justice, the statistic, no matter how we measure it, is just remarkably robust, that about 70% of justice-involved youth have diagnosable conditions, and studies at Northwestern University really detailed that not only do they have one, but they have more than one diagnosis, and almost always one of those diagnoses is also substance abuse. So they have had a long chain of failures that have led to what I refer to elsewhere in this handout as accumulating comorbidities, which means if you have one disorder and it's not treated or not treated successfully, the likelihood of acquiring another is very likely. I tell the ADHD story very often where statistically it really looks like once you have that and it's not treated, it's highly likely that you can acquire learning disabilities, conduct disorder and or oppositional defiant disorder and depression, and usually in that order. And so we really face serious problems if we don't intervene early, and hence our concern with trying to reach this population. This was the first time. This is about a $4.6 million grant that we administer through all Minnesota counties. This was our first experience in doing a performance-based grant to county boards who are responsible for both child welfare and juvenile justice. with creating allocations that were based on a previous year's performance. So instead of just giving it on the basis of population, we actually looked at what they were doing and then rewarded those who were doing the best job. The appropriation, as I said earlier, does not pay just for screening, but also for diagnostic and treatment services, again, for that uninsured and underinsured population. And collectively, we know right now that about 38% of the grants go for screening and administration of the whole programs, and about 60% directly for services that are not otherwise reimbursed. I'm nearing the end. It's very important that we know that the mandate in this screening program is a mandate to the agencies to offer the screening, not a mandatory individual screen. So, and I hope that makes sense. The child welfare social worker or the probation officer must offer the screening, but it is always the purview of the family to accept or decline that screening. And that's true even in systems that have some mandatory control over the child. The legislation also does not allow DHS to collect any individual data about the results of a screening or, therefore, about any of the subsequent services, which does limit our ability to know very much about what's actually happening other than those gross fiscal figures that I just reported to you. We do get some summary statistics on juvenile justice. The Department of Corrections actually gathers this through their information system for us. So we know the numbers that are reported there, that about 7,800 youth are eligible for screening in that system. In 2009, about 4,700 of those were actually screened. About 1,600 were above threshold and were referred for other services, primarily for diagnostic assessment, which is what's actually, absolutely, what is necessary after a screen. The screen does not establish a diagnosis. The screen only says, something's going on here that needs a further look. So we're very happy when the next step is a diagnostic assessment. In child welfare, we get only aggregate statistics through our social services information system, and so we know that roughly the same number of children, about 7,700, were eligible for screening. The screening rate is not quite as great in the child welfare system, with about 3,400 actually screened. And that is what we have at this moment.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman.
Ms. Sedwalk, maybe I should refer to you as Dr. Edwalk. Is that appropriate?
Thank you.
I appreciate your coming today. Could you maybe just clarify for purposes of understanding, in your presentation, one of the first slides says the 2002 Children's Mental Health Task Force established some questions. How long has the division been in place? Was that also established at the same time, or had that been established prior?
I came in 2000. My recollection is the division was established in 97. So it was about 5 years into the existence of the Children's Mental Health Division.
And could you, as an overview, the size of the budget that we had in 2002 devoted to your division, and if I'm looking at the right information here, is it correct that I've got a chart here on page 9 of the handout that talks about 2009 public mental health services for children, about $205 million. Is that correct?
Correct.
Was that comparable to what we saw in 2002, or what has been the growth of the budget over the period of time?
It's tremendous growth, but Mr. Cox is coaching me here, who was here before me, that most of the growth has been in our Minnesota healthcare programs, in our Medicaid spending. In fact, our grant programs are about the same now as they were at that time, but they've risen and fallen over time. In 2003, the grants that we had had up to that point were taken into the CCSA fund, consolidated, and have subsequently seen, of course, some decreases, but they were no longer administered by our division. And then we saw about the equivalent amount of funding restored or in changed form, though, in the 2007 legislature.
Okay. Thank you. Are there other Senator Rosen?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. Edwall and Dr. Gunner, this is pretty powerful up there at that testifying table. You two are powerhouses in this arena, and you've done some amazing work. And Dr. Gunner, very nice to have you here because your reputation is quite outstanding in this area. And if just wanted to go back to the slides on page 4 of the science of the early brain development that we kind of skipped over. That is, and I'm just going to rattle here for a second, but for all the time I've been here, it's just slowly a learning experience on mental health and the brain development and how crucial that is, actually even prenatal, but from birth on, how important it is and to get this right for our children, because it is a prevention measure. And I completely understand that. We still have a lot of work to do. We've come a long way in this arena of early childhood development. But I think this is extremely important to focus and zero in on this for the future of our children and of Minnesota and our healthcare costs, because this is where you can definitely make a difference. I do have a couple questions, though, and that was for Dr. Edwall. That was on the where's my notes? Oh, thank you. Senator Nienhaus rescued me. The Incredible Years, where is that program at and how is that delivered?
Dr. Edwall.
Senator Rosen, Chair. I would have to actually go back to our grant manager to give you the specific locations. Were you curious also, though, about the structure of the program?
The structure of the program.
The structure
right.
of the program is that Incredible Years comprises three elements: a parent group, a child group, and a teacher group. And they all have parallel curricula so that as children are learning essentially self-regulatory skills, their parents are also learning how to recognize those and reward and reinforce them in ways that are parallel with what their teachers are doing too. It's a remarkably well-researched but also very flexible curriculum that is used in a lot of settings, primarily as a preventative program for kids who may have several risk factors or are beginning to manifest some difficulties. Administered in greater intensity and duration, it also serves as a very effective intervention for children who already have diagnosed conditions. Okay. We have the Midwest Training Center for the Incredible Years here at the Wilder Foundation, and so much of the work that we do is actually cooperative work with Wilder around that.
Okay. Mr. Chair?
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Dr. Edwall. Also, can you explain how the interaction is with some of the other early childhood initiatives with your division? Are they addressing this mental health, the children's mental health area, such as MELF or whoever else is
on
it? Senator Rosen and Chair. I do believe, while we have very good and collegial relationships with all of the other early childhood serving systems, we do understand that we have a unique niche. We certainly want to support all of their work that makes for better environments for children and better chances at learning. But we really believe, as a single state authority for mental health, that we have a special responsibility for the children who are already manifesting diagnosable conditions. And so we have a somewhat separate and different function.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
I certainly hope there is a collaboration with all those organizations.
There's a collaboration
too.
In every way we possibly can,
Thank
yes.
you. And, Mr. Chair, one more
Senator
question.
Senator Rosen.
This could be for Dr. Gunner or Dr. Edwall. Is that the some of the focus that's been on the school-based mental health programs? Can you give us a little frame-up of that and how important that is to continue that program, the successes, and where it came from, and just
Dr. Edwall or Dr. Gunner?
Dr. Gunner, I think I'll let you off the hook on that.
Thank
one.
You.
Yes, yes.
Dr. Gunner.
Senator Rosen and Chair, thank you very much for that. We also are very grateful for the funding from the legislature in 2007 for our school-linked mental health services program. And we're careful about that because it is not a school function, and sometimes that becomes unclear when we talk about school-based. So school-linked services. This is a program where we provide grants to providers who in turn have cooperative agreements with schools to provide their services either at the school site or through referral to an agency that might be able to deliver the services in home and community settings as well. And my recollection, because I did not bring this data with me today, but my recollection is that we are in 58 counties with that program, that about, well, I think a little under $5 million a year goes into that. We have been collecting this outcome data that's parallel to what I described for the early childhood system using the CASI and the SDQ. It's a remarkably, I think, successful and popular program in terms of providers and families and schools all being extremely enthusiastic about how much it aids learning. Very much like the structure of the early childhood grants that I did talk about, it includes both clinical services, where there is an expectation that the providers will seek reimbursement from a third-party source wherever that is available, and then the grant pays the margins for uninsured and underinsured children. And then the grant also pays for ancillary services, largely, again, family consultations and teacher consultations to try to keep everyone who is concerned with the care of a child who may be experiencing difficulties as well coordinated as possible. Thank you very much for asking about that program.
Thank you. Senator Berkley.
Mr. Chairman, I wanted to just point out, because I know it doesn't show up under under the Children's Mental Health Division or Dr. Edwall's supervision, but last session, beginning this year, we did pass a program for psychiatric consultation. And this is because a lot of times a child, partly due to our workforce shortages and partly due to access issues, ends up with a family physician or sometimes a pediatrician when they've been diagnosed with mental health issues, who is managing that care. And so for children that have a high amount of prescription, mental health prescriptions allocated to them, we did create this psychiatric consultation program so that there is a psychiatrist that actually talks to these doctors about things that could be tried before the medication would be used. And we did get a savings on that in the fiscal note. And so I know there are some people here today that are concerned about the amount of medication that some children get, and I just wanted to point out that that program has started this year.
Thank you, Senator Brickle. Any other questions for our witnesses?
Well, Mr. Chair, no, thank you. Just another comment on, I remember reading a book, Ghost in the Nursery by Robin Karmoris. And our little community of Fairmont, some of you, Senator Berglund, might know this story, they flew her in from Portland to give a talk for 2 days to all the healthcare professionals, teachers, daycare providers, police, whatever, filled the Opera House up 2 nights in a row. And it was just an amazing discovery for all of us to know how the brain develops and how important it is to get to those children early and the proper development. And it's so very simple to start that child out right with the proper care and nurturing and just simple things. And you talk about the toxic stress issues in here, and this is so preventable. That's what's amazing. A lot of our problems we could have been dealing with earlier. Is it the school's responsibility or is it the community's responsibility or the parents' responsibility? Well, it's all of ours, and much more the parents, of course, but sometimes we have to step in too, and that's, I was very proud of my community for doing that, and they have been very aggressive on their mental health area and drug abuse area and all that with the children. And so I just wanted to say that this is really important. Really important.
Thank you. Thanks, mm-hmm. Senator Rosen. Any other questions? Thank you, doctors, for coming today. We appreciate your testimony. And I would like to invite Mr. Anderson to join us. And please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you for having us here this morning, Senator Hahn. My name is John Anderson. I'm the acting co-director of the Adult Mental Health Division of DHS. Just should maybe also introduce the other co-directors. Our director resigned, or retired rather, back in November. Dave Schultz is also in the audience, and Cynthia Godin. We're holding down the fort until we get a new director. The adult mental health division, along with the children's mental health division, operate as the state mental health authority. And really what that means is we implement policy and we coordinate the overall statewide mental health system. We distribute dollars and funding to counties and providers for the purpose of developing a community mental health system. And why is that important? It's important because since 1980, where we had an average census in our state hospitals of around 1,300 a day, now it is down to less than 150, probably about 115 at Anoka State Hospital. And so what we've been charged with is to establish an effective alternative to institutional care. The primary focus is to reduce the negative impact of mental illness by promoting safety, stability, and recovery for persons with mental illness. And we do that with our county partners and with other providers in the state of Minnesota. Let me direct your attention to how the system is funded on page 7 of your handout. It shows the mix of funding that exists. You see that the system, as it's described here, is $600 million. A large portion of that is paid through medical assistance. A few years back, we moved in this direction, where prior to that, we were funding a lot of the adult mental health system through state grants. I'm going to go kind of clockwise around the graph there. The little slice of the pie called GMC, this is 09 figures, and right now that's cut by about two-thirds. That's the situation we find ourselves in after the last legislative session.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Higgins.
Could you tell us which of all of this paper you're talking about?
Page 7, the pie.
Show us the front of it.
Page 7 of...
Show us the front of the document.
Senator Higgins, it's the Health and Human Services Finance Committee hearing.
And then page 7.
Page
Thank
7.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for calling that out, Senator Higgins. And go ahead, Mr. Anderson.
Okay.
Too much paper.
Okay. I also have trouble with microphones. Alrighty. So you see the, Chairman, you see the pie chart and MA, GMC, and the next one is Minnesota Care. And our partners with the counties fund still contribute a significant portion to the pie in funding mental health services. The next slice over from social services, GRH, that's the group residential housing funds that support the room and board costs for our residences, for our residential programs. RTC funds, community mental health grants, and then other. Below that chart, the next chart down, these are the services that we fund. And you'll see that, again, on the right-hand side of the chart, almost half of the pie is still state-operated services. We have 18%, almost 19% going to RTCs, and the CBHH system is almost 23%. The next slice down are residential programs called intensive residential treatment, and then community support programs, ARMS, and assertive community treatment. And I'll get into those programs with more detail just in a little bit. Case management and outpatient. So you get a sense of how the system is funded and then what services are being purchased with that funding. If you turn to page 8, it shows you the various grants and contracts that we have in play right now. The oldest funding that we have is Rural 78, Community Support Program funding. And this was money that was given out to counties to develop the community mental health system in all 87 of the counties. And it was given out primarily on a formula basis. And it provides a lot of supportive type services and has been part of a critical part of the safety net, especially during this time when GMC went away. And counties often use this grant, Rural 78, to fund services for the uninsured population. The next row is the Adult Integrated Fund. And that's $64 million, and that's typically, most of that money goes to funding the 16 regional adult mental health initiatives. And what we've got are all the counties of the state have formed into initiative areas. And this is, the work of the initiatives has been almost exclusively to plan for service alternatives in lieu of the state hospitals. So that's where the bulk of our money is going right now. We also spend money, next row down, for hospital alternatives, and that's to extend the length of stays for people who are in inpatient settings and also to subsidize the operation of those hospitals. And again, this was put in place to take the pressure off of our institutions like Anoka. I'm going to skip down. We have a number of grants that are important, but they're not that large. I wanted to underscore the fact that we have federal block grant money in play. We do demonstration projects with that. They're typically short-term projects. That's what funds the Consumer Survivor Network, for instance, in Minnesota, and funds a couple other projects on a demonstration basis. Beneath that are the grants that we give out to the Native American projects. We have 12 projects existing on the reservations and in the metro area serving Native American persons who have mental health needs. So I'm not going to go into any more detail about this chart unless you guys have specific questions.
Continue.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
I'm sorry, Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman Mr. Anderson, I'm not sure if you're the right person to ask this question of, but I'm interested to know whether the RFP that went out to the counties to provide alternative services that would relieve two units at Anoka, whether that RFP has been granted yet.
Mr. Anderson.
Senator Hahn, Senator Berglund, the RFP is still in process. It's about ready to go out. We expect responses to the RFP early April, probably the first week of April.
Mr. Anderson, I'd just like to point out that the last time, excuse me, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Anderson, the last time you reported on this to the division in November, the RFP was going out to be responded to by mid-January. And I can only tell you that we've been trying to get you guys to do this project for over 2 years now. So every time somebody tells me it's been delayed another 2 months, I am not happy. And I would just remind those of you in the department that administer this, that every day that goes by that we do not revise the way we provide these services, we are losing critical mental health housing dollars that are needed in the community.
Mr. Anderson, any comment on the delay that is taking place in this?
We did send out an RFI in the time frame that Senator Berglund talked about, and that sought input from the counties. And the goal of that was to have the counties inform us about just how we ought to structure the RFP and essentially how to proceed. So that went out, and now the second phase of that is to do an RFP. and it's well conceptualized. It provides the counties and providers in the metro area with a lot of direction and specifics about just what needs to be accomplished here. We have just recently met with all the stakeholders, including the counties, and we continue to engage them about the process, and that will go on.
Mr. Anderson, just to Senator Berglund's point, are you prepared to make some commitment to the timetable this is going to occur, just going forward, what's going to happen and when?
Senator Berglund, yes. Let me just say this, that the RFP should be out of the department, should have cleared all the hurdles there within the next couple of weeks. We expect the responses to be due back somewhere early April. We will review those responses. Some of the service models that we're putting on the table and proposing are ones that could be implemented fairly quickly. The goal is to have the state start clocking savings by July 1st of this year.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Anderson, do you recall what the statute envisioned in terms of the timetable for this?
Mr. Anderson.
Chairman Hahn, Senator Berglund, I don't recall the exact wording of the statute.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Anderson, the first timetable was for this to be implemented in 2009, by November of 2009. The second timetable, because the first timetable was not met, was indicated that it should be implemented by November of 2010.
Mr. Anderson?
I don't really, Chairman Hahn, I don't really have much of a response other than we do appreciate the pressure and the interest that Senator Berglund has on this project, and we are moving it ahead as quickly as possible.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Thank you, Senator Berglund, for your question, and we'll just keep in touch with you on the progress of this. Did you have continued your presentation?
Sure. Thank you, sir. Chairman Hahn, I don't know what you have exactly in front of you, but I'd direct your attention to the summary that's attached or that you've been given that starts with the line business area. Do you have that?
Mr. Anderson, is this the one-page business area, Chemical and Mental Health Services Division, Adult Mental Health? Is that what you're referring
That's
to?
That's exactly
It's a
right.
one-page document?
Yes, Senator. Much of this I've already covered, but I did want to point out on the second page, or what I page two of it, we give a listing of all the different mental health services, and you can get a sense then of how many people have been served in each of those areas. I also wanted to underscore the future challenges that we see, and critical to us moving forward is the availability of safe, affordable housing and related supports, particularly for those that have poor rental histories or criminal backgrounds. These are individuals who have, even if they had a voucher, would have trouble finding housing. We also are anticipating and are experiencing, rather, workforce shortages in greater Minnesota, in particular, of professionally trained staff. Even though we're trying to resolve it, and I think progress is made in this area, we work in silos. We have the different disability groups, and we're putting a lot of effort these days into breaking down those barriers because they don't work for our clients, especially those with complex needs. And so to the degree that we can remove those funding, regulatory barriers, between our disciplines, that serves everybody, including our clients. The changing demographics in Minnesota is also a challenge. Those in trying to meet the needs of the immigrant populations, and also as people age, as the entire population ages, these are important concerns that we have. We also are concerned about the fragility of a number of our mental health providers, that in looking at their financial health, many of them are operating with no cash reserves or 1 to 2 months at most. And so this is an important part of the safety net and the infrastructure, and it's important to pay attention to making sure that they have enough money to operate. A lot has been talked about in terms of the life expectancy of people with mental illness. And clearly, if you have a mental illness, you belong to a cohort that where maybe your life expectancy could be as much as 25 years shorter than average. And so linking mental health services with primary care seems to be very important. And then finally, the last challenge is not pointed out here, but it's obvious that a lot of our work these days also has to do with the implementation of the federal health care reform and initiative. And so a lot of work is going into making sure that the eligibility lines up and that the people with mental illness fit into that new system. Any questions?
Members, any questions for Mr. Anderson? Thank you. Appreciate your coming today, and I'm sure we'll have further opportunity to talk with you.
Thank you, Chairman Hahn.
I want to invite Mr. Tesnier, if he is here. And thank you for coming this morning. We're running a little short on time, and I don't want to necessarily shortchange you, and all I will say is if we need further time to hear your presentation or respond to questions, we can certainly follow up at another committee hearing, possibly on Monday, if that's suitable for your schedule. But if you'd like to introduce yourself and begin, we'll see how far we get.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Mike Tesnier. I'm Chief Executive Officer. Good morning, members of the committee, Mr. Chair. My name is Mike Tesnier. I'm a Chief Executive Officer from State Operating Services, the Department of Human Services. Senator Hahn, how much time do I have? Because I'll tailor my comments to the window that you give me.
Go ahead. Thank you.
Okay. I'm going to be speaking from this document and starting on page 12. There's a grid that shows, it's at the top of the page, it's titled Chemical Mental Health Services, State Operated Services, far left-hand corner. This is an overview that shows the care center, which is the type of services that we're providing within State Operated Services, the actual FTEs in each one, the number of sites, the 2011 fiscal year budget, the number of folks that we serve, whether it's funded by appropriation or enterprise or dedicated revenue, and then the licensing and certification of the organization. Let me start with some overall comments. State Operated Services has the responsibility for serving individuals with very complex co-occurring disorders throughout the state of Minnesota. We do that through a number of different programs, which I'll touch on here shortly. We serve about 12,000 people a year, individual persons touched each year, and that can be everything from hospitalization to residential services, vocational services, crisis services, chemical dependency inpatient and outpatient services. Moving to the far left-hand column under adult mental health services, as you can see there, that includes the Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center, the Community Behavioral Health Hospitals, Minnesota Specialty Care, Community Partnership Network, and Crisis Services. This is an array of services provided, both inpatient hospitalization services, primarily at this point through the Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center and the CBHHs. The Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center essentially runs full at all times with a waiting list of somewhere between 50 and 70 individuals waiting in community hospitals for admission. the CBHHs, which have undergone some changes in the last year and a half, going from 10 down to 7 at present. We're running about 80% full. Average daily census there is somewhere between 10 to 12. There is no waiting list. Individuals typically come to us through community hospital emergency departments and sometimes the county jail system. The utilization of Anoka, we serve about a little over 2.5 times the number of people in the CBHHs over the Anoka hospital, primarily because the average length of stay in the Anoka hospital is around 100 days. The average length of stay in the CBHHs runs about 20 days or less. So in other words, we have people flowing through the CBHH system much quicker than the Anoka system. And to Senator Berglund's comment, that is the driving force behind the need for the redesign of that program. There are people getting services at Anoka who don't need that level of care and could get a different level of care, which would be more efficient and effective and responsive to their need than what we're currently doing. Moving to the Child and Adolescent Behavioral Health Services, we do two main components out of this. One is the Child and Adolescent Behavioral Health Hospital in Willmar. It's a 16-bed hospital specializing in serving children who need acute inpatient and usually longer lengths of stay than are available in other community hospital settings. These kids, once again, are characteristic of very complex disorders, co-occurring disorders. The average length of stay there, I believe, is somewhere around 40 days. The average census is running around somewhere between 10 to 12. The community services in the child and adolescent area are what we refer to as MIF homes. They're intensive foster placements. There's one child in each home. The foster parent is a state employee, but they are bringing that child into their home. It's the services are supported by really round-the-clock professional services on call and available to ensure that it's a successful placement. These were children that heretofore became stuck in our hospital system. This allows them to return to the community and live in a foster site. One of the responsibilities of that foster care provider and the team that supports that child is reuniting with a family when that's possible or with the next place where that child's going to live. In other words, it's an interim service arrangement. Community support services is comprised of a team of individuals, everything from direct care staff to nurses, psychologists, behavior analysts, social workers. They provide an intensive set of consultation and wraparound services in the community to ensure that individuals, primarily people with developmental disabilities, but also people with developmental disabilities, mental illness, or traumatic brain injury, access to services that can stabilize them and help them remain in the community successfully. We operate 5 dental clinics throughout the state. These are serving primarily people with mental retardation, developmental disabilities, other disabling conditions who are not able to access dental care from other providers. We serve about 5,000 individuals, 4,400 individuals a year through that service. Our forensic services are located out of the St. Peter community. The Minnesota Security Hospital is our secure residential and intensive treatment setting. It serves individuals primarily who are committed mentally ill and dangerous, which means a committing court has determined that they are have reached a threshold where they present a risk to public safety. It's an indeterminate commitment status, so they are essentially placed into this program by court order, and they're also discharged from the program by court action. The average length of stay in the security hospital is for persons discharged is about 7.5 years. The transitional services is still located on the St. Peter campus, serves almost 100 people. It serves almost 80 people. It serves individuals who are coming out of the security hospital. So in other words, they've been residing in a secure treatment setting through the special review board process, which is an administrative and legal process. They are granted the transfer from the secure setting to the open campus. On the open campus, they begin the process of reintegration to the community. That program, once again, between security hospital and the transition program, the average length of stay for folks discharged is 7.5 years. The forensic nursing home is, at this point, it's actually in a building license for 48 beds. We're operating half of those beds at present. Average census right now is running about 18 people. The focus of that program is serving individuals who are either under an MIND commitment, a sexual dangerous person commitment, sexual psychopathic personality commitment, or people on medical release from corrections. This is the service that used to be provided in the Agua Ching nursing home prior to its closure. The adolescent YAP program is the young adult and adolescent population that we're serving. These are individuals. This program was actually begun about 4 years ago. We looked at the cross-section of the security hospital, realizing that we had a number of individuals who were in their late teens, young adult, who had relatively catastrophic life experiences prior to coming to us. When we did an analysis of folks who entered in there in that age range, roughly 18 through 25, that their average length of stay, actually no one had left. So in other words, they were becoming institutionalized and couldn't get out the back door of our system. So we made a conscious decision to create a young adult program. The focus of that is these folks all live together. They work together. They go to school together, if that's still appropriate. They recreate together. The focus of the program is to provide a developmental approach and programming and hopefully give them a chance to recover and return to the community at some point. We also operate the treat to competency program. Individuals who have some type of criminal charge laid against them, who the court has determined are not competent to proceed to trial, but can perhaps be competent, get committed to us. Our obligation is to provide treatment for their disabling condition, most often mental illness, and return them to competency so that they can return to the criminal court. And that program is also located at St. Peter. I know I'm going kind of fast, but I'm mindful of the time. So if there are questions, please interrupt me. The Minnesota Extended Treatment Option, this program was created in the mid-90s by legislative action, specifically targeting individuals with developmental disabilities who present a risk to public safety. At that time, we believed that was the most appropriate setting and treatment strategy. We've learned a great deal about this population, and both on based upon our experience and legislative action, we've undertaken the redesign of this program. The redesign actually is imminent. We're beginning to post positions, but it's probably far more detailed than you wish to know today, but I'd be happy to share information as that unfolds. The MSOCS program, this is Minnesota State Operated Community Services. This is long-term residential supports primarily for individuals, also vocational training for individuals throughout the state. As you can see by the numbers, we have 135 residential sites, primarily four-bed group homes and 15 six-bed ICF-MR programs, and then 19 day training rehabilitation, vocational training sites. The initial focus of this program at its inception in the early 90s was serving persons with developmental disabilities. That is no longer the case. Most of the services we're providing now that are new to us are serving individuals with perhaps developmental disabilities, mental illness, traumatic brain injury, or a combination of those. Folks with a long history of the community services failing them and us coming our way, usually from one of our programs such as Anoka, St. Peter, or the MEDO program, where we're developing services particularly tailored to their individual needs back in the community. That's kind of a snapshot picture of what we do. Are there any questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Tesner, are there any of, I'm going to use this word loosely, group homes that are operated by state-operated services that are under threat of closure?
Mr. Tesner?
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, I'm not aware of any that are currently in a financial situation that would cause that. There have been over the last several years, as pressure has come on waivered rates, those are usually negotiated between the county, the folks living there are their families, guardians, to make sure that folks have a place to move to. Oftentimes as well, we've adjusted the level of services we provide to operate within those dollar amounts. So we're used to that activity at this point, although I'm not aware of any homes that are currently at risk of closure.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Tesner, as the session progresses and various budgets are proposed, if you would keep us informed of that, any change in that status.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, I'd be happy to.
Thank you.
I'm going to move you to documents, and I'll try to be brief here, but there's some information that I think you'll find helpful. This is the State Operated Services background sheet, and it's on page, actually starting on top of page 5. The top graph represents, which I think is significant, the number of folks coming to us who are on a hold status. You can see there's a substantial dip that occurs between 2004 and 2006. That represents when the CBHH system came online. In other words, fewer people were coming to us under some type of a hold, and that's been maintained relatively stable since the advent. What that means, I think, to the patient, to the family, is it's a voluntary action. They're still coming in for care, but they're coming in of their own volition. Someone's not in an emergency department or law enforcement placing a hold on them and moving them into treatment. The bottom graph shows the total FTE for state-operated services from 2002 to 10. The dramatic jump downward from really in 2008, 2009 is an artifact of moving the Minnesota Sex Offender Program out of state-operated services, still within the Department of Services. Department of Human Services, there's a footnote. If you have a magnifying glass, you can see clearly. I can still see it. 728 FTEs. But if you look at the total reduction between 08 and present, it's somewhere in excess of 240 FTEs. Most of that has come in reorganization within state-operated services by closing services that were no longer necessary because another provider was willing to step forward and do it, closing services that we were operating that had more staff dedicated to a service that we could do with fewer staff, that sort of thing. And then the next page on the top of page 6, this represents, and this is important, and I'm sorry to say, but I think the committee does need to understand, for those of you that haven't been involved with us, a substantial movement away from space being owned by the state and operated. And this represents primarily the old regional treatment centers. If you look at the number of square feet, has dropped substantially. That translates to dollars that have already been taken from our budget. Acres of land, likewise. Since 2002, we have turned over ownership of the Wilmer Regional Treatment Center, the Fergus Falls Regional Treatment Center, the Agua Ching Regional Treatment Center into alternative ownership from the state. We still do lease some space at Wilmer, but we don't no longer own the property. We still, however, maintain ownership of the Brainerd Regional Human Services Center. It's currently for sale, and we are working with admin on this with the local community to ensure that there is some type of a transfer of that property because it's not something that we find useful in our current mission.
All right. Thank you.
So I hope this information is helpful. There's more here in the packet that I did not go over. I'd be happy to stand for any questions or to come back at your wish.
Are there questions from the committee?
Senator Hahn.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Tesner. Would you go back again to
the graph at the bottom of 5, in which you describe the sharp reduction in FTEs and the separation of the budgets, I think, was
yes.
the request of the legislature, so there could be clarity in understanding those. But would you just talk about what the motivation for the change was, what this reflects about that, and then what it doesn't? Where does the change show up someplace else? Where does the portion of the budget that's not reflected, where did it go?
Mr. Tessier.
Okay, Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon. During 2008, a decision was made to separate the Minnesota Sex Offender Program from state-operated services. This was primarily born out of our experience with the Sex Offender Program and state-operated services trying to, if you will, meld two cultures. What we have learned over time, Mr. Dennis Benson, who's the current executive director of the Sex Offender Program, will have much more information for you about this. But what we learned over time is the distinct differences between individuals committed as sexual psychopaths or sexually dangerous persons versus people committed for mental health treatment. The vast majority of people coming into the Minnesota Sex Offender Program have long criminal histories that characterize the way that they are on a day-to-day basis. 99% of them are coming out of the Department of Corrections. If you contrast that with the Minnesota Security Hospital, very few of those individuals have been convicted of a crime. Those individuals have been involved with the criminal justice system. Typically, the criminal charges were dropped or they were found not guilty by reason of insanity. So they were deemed by a court not to be responsible for their actions, but they were committed for treatment. So they don't have long criminal histories. They're not predisposed to additional criminal activity as is present in the sex offender program. Based upon that, there's a very different level of security and attentiveness and treatment needs from the Minnesota Security Hospital versus the sex offender program. So all of that brought us to the conclusion that we needed to separate those two. In separating those two, as Senator Schoener points out, part of that is staff, part of that is budget. In doing that, there were 728.5 FTEs that went over to the sex offender side of that equation, and then the remainder of services stayed within the security hospital. I don't remember your last question. I'm sorry.
Well, if I look at this and I see this drop in FTEs, I should expect to see something when you take a look at the sex offenders program that reflects this change. And wasn't it also a concern that there was, by combined budgetary process and service projects, not only the differences in the population, but how the budget was, dollars were fungible between the two systems, and it was difficult for us to truly measure what was impacting this, the growth of the costs in the budget.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Tessman. Senator Sharon, I think that's correct. And the sex offender uptick will be on a graph that Mr. Benson has. So all this is showing you the impact that occurred on state-operated services.
Thank you. Other questions for Mr. Tester? Members, I know we're over our time, and we did have at least one person, and I've been informed there's some other people that may have wanted to make comments. I think what I'd like to do is continue this on Monday. We will not meet tomorrow because of the State of the State address, and what I'd like to do is take some time Monday at the start of our hearing and perhaps invite the folks here that can provide information or comment on the mental health grants, and also Mr. Weiss, if you could also, we'll send a message out, but I think there are some additional questions we'd like to follow up and give the people who have not had a chance to make comments, give them an opportunity to testify as well. Ms. Ephraim, I apologize for not getting to you today. We'll hear you on Monday, and I know there's some other folks that have also expressed some interest, and we will do that on Monday as well. So again, a reminder, we will not meet tomorrow and do the State of the State, and with that, we are adjourned.